Hi there, and welcome to this week's episode of Over and Under. My name's Kareem Mohsen, and I'm going to be joined this week by Michael Manziello.
Hi there.
And Oktay Ege-Kozak.
How's it going?
Every week, we're going to be looking at one overrated film and comparing it with one underappreciated film. Our films for this week, the overrated film, which is my choice, is Limitless, the 2011 film starring Bradley Cooper and Robert De Niro. And Michael Manziello is going to be choosing Seconds, the 1966 film starring Rock Hudson. I'm going to begin with Limitless. I chose Limitless because Mike initially chose Seconds as his underappreciated film. And I wanted to choose a similar narrative about a guy who gets a second lease on life, which is basically what Seconds is about. I chose Limitless because actually I quite liked the film when I first watched it. I never thought it was a brilliant film, and I never thought it was a master film, but I did enjoy it, and I've watched it a couple of times since, and I actually, every time I watch it, I'm like, why the hell did I like this film? The reason that I find this film kind of disappointing, I think from a narrative perspective, I'm thinking, okay, so the story, just to give you guys a heads up, is about a young, frustrated writer who can't seem to find inspiration. And at the beginning of the film, he gets dumped by his girlfriend. And what happens is he meets this brother of his ex-wife, who's this deadbeat drug dealer who has this new drug. And what the drug does is $800 a pop. And when you take it, it helps you to access the dormant reservoirs of potential in your mind, in your brain, so that all of a sudden you move from a 3-figure IQ to a 4-figure IQ. That by itself is a pretty interesting concept, because I don't know what the percentage is, but people say that we only use a very small percentage of our brain. So a drug that could help us expand that would be an interesting idea. The problem is that what happens to this guy is that he goes from being a frustrated writer and he takes the drug and all of a sudden his mind becomes clear and he's able to write the manuscript and all of a sudden he writes this incredible book. But after he's done that, he decides he can go on to bigger and better things. So he moves from being a writer to a stockbroker. And to me, that was just a weird transition. It's like, if you're an artist and you suddenly become a lot more intelligent, would you naturally want to become someone who makes obscene amounts of money? I don't think that that's necessarily the transition. So I think that's the kind of flat, two-dimensional worldview that the film creates, and it's a little bit upsetting to me. What about you guys? Did you guys have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think I agree with you on that. It's almost like the film is telling you that if you become that intelligent and you become one of the smartest people in the world, all you're going to be doing is to find out how to make tons and tons of money. And when I first saw this, I thought he was going to become one of the greatest writers of all time or something like that. And then when it took that turn, it just felt like too kind of easy and typical to me.
Yeah, I mean, if you have access to your unconscious and this kind of wide intellect, as an artist, you could become the greatest artist of all time. And I think that would be a way more worthwhile contribution to humanity than earning, you know, another million, billion,
yeah,
whatever.
Just to become like a douchebag banker.
Yeah.
Especially like right after the recession, when everybody hates people like that. It was an interesting choice.
I think what's something interesting about that is that, like, art is not really a thing that you can solve, or, you know, you can be, like, intelligence can help somebody to be a better artist, but you have to actually have an artistic soul, I think, or something, you know, and, like, it's weird that he somehow writes this great book in 4 days, and then he doesn't have any more desire to delve deeper into that part of himself, which is what defined him before, and it just seems like a weird thing for a character to do in a movie. If they had just stuck with that initial premise, that I think would have made for a much more interesting film.
Yeah, and I agree.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, it was kind of like a poor man's version of The Matrix, because in The Matrix, he takes this pill, you know, and all of a sudden, the Oz's curtain is revealed, and behind this, you see this matrix of what's really going on behind, you know, what we perceive to be reality. But when he takes the pill, all that happens is that he climbs the ladder of the current version of reality. So he just becomes, you know, basically a poster boy for success, driving fast cars, sleeping with lots of beautiful women, traveling, having fancy conversations, dressing well. But there wasn't anything that went beyond that, and I thought that was disappointing, because what they could have explored is altered states of consciousness, which they touch on at the end, because he starts to develop his other perceptions and senses, but it's touched on in a very mediocre way. So I thought that was a kind of missed opportunity.
It almost shows you what would happen if the person who gets taken out of the Matrix wasn't Neo, but like kind of a selfish asshole. Because that's pretty much it's pretty much the same thing, isn't it? Like, he takes the pill, and like in the Matrix, he can download all these amazing information and skills in a matter of seconds, and becomes great at them. And this is kind of the same thing. He takes the pill, and he can read books or write books in a matter of days, and I mean, matter of minutes, and he can just solve these very complex problems. And it was kind of showing that same thing. But yeah, he uses those powers for absolutely selfish reasons, and that's why it becomes harder to root for him near the end.
Yeah, and I think all his conflicts are external, and all his motivations are external too. Like, it doesn't seem like he's really motivated by anything within him, which is really makes for like a kind of a dull story after a while, because everything has to be resolved by like some like gunfight or, you know, something ridiculous like that, not like an actual decision or mental thing that he could do.
Yeah, that's true. It's just that, and it also starts off with him being this frustrated artist. So you think there's going to be something internal there. Maybe he takes the pill and he doesn't like what he finds in his subconscious and he wants to get away from that. There are so many other options for a story premise like that, and it just turns into this very dull, predictable thriller with tons of plot holes.
And for me, it's just another kind of example in a long list of examples of films that are trying to ride the coattails of other films like Fight Club and The Matrix. Both Fight Club and The Matrix were brilliant films when they came up, I think because they were on the cutting edge and because they explored new territory, like philosophical territory, and also like visual and narrative territories that were like unlike anything I'd ever seen before in movies. But I get really frustrated when films, you know, however many years later, when did Fight Club come out?
Maybe it was like 99. It's the same year, actually. They both came out in 99,
right? And then however many years later, we're in 2013, or when this film came out in 2011, it seems like films haven't gone beyond that level of creativity, you know? They're still copying and borrowing from that. And that feels really frustrating. Even, like, the color palettes of certain scenes were like, oh, that's just a rip-off of The Matrix. Or the opening scene where, you know, he's standing on the edge of a building. It's just like, that's a wannabe Fight Club.
Yeah, the voiceover had, like, the same kind of quality as the voiceover from Fight Club, which is, like, this kind of straightforward, honest kind of narrative, as if it's not like a professionally written voiceover, but just kind of you're inside the mind of the character or something like that. So that was very similar as well.
Yeah, the voiceover, the thing that really bugged me about it right from the start, because I knew the basic premise about the pills, is he didn't sound that smart from the way he was talking. You know, it's like if you're this hyper genius, your voiceover should be this beautifully written, well-crafted thought all the time, but it just sounded like a screenwriter guy who graduated from UCLA or something.
Yeah, that's one of the things that bugged me as well with premises like this, and I think there's really no way around it, because the people who write these films, they cannot use their minds 100% either. So after a while, you're going to get stuck with some really terrible ideas, but this one kind of takes the cake. Like, there's that one scene where the bad guy is chasing his girlfriend, and he tells his girlfriend to take the pill, and that the pill will give her a way out. And the thing that she can think of after taking the pill is to put a little child's life in danger by using her skates to like slit the guy's face or something. And that just like didn't look like the smartest thing to do to me.
Yeah, no, I remember that, thinking that yesterday when I watched it. I was like, wow, out of all the millions of scenarios you could have chosen, jumping onto the ice rink, picking up a child, and slashing the pursuer's face with the ice skates, I was like, wow, that's pretty crazy.
Yeah, she's basically putting that kid's life in danger.
Right.
I feel like there's like 8 parts taken out of this screenplay where they explain that it turns you into a jerk.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense there, because everybody who takes this pill, I mean, you can understand that terrible Russian stereotype mafia guy, when he takes the pill, you can understand that he turns into a jerk. But everybody else in the film that takes the pill just turns into this giant selfish asshole.
Yeah, and you'll never get away from that. I mean, we were talking about the Russian guy. You're saying that he was a stereotype. I quite enjoyed his character because I compare him with the John Malkovich character in Rounders, and I think compared to him, he's probably the most credible Russian actor I've ever seen.
That's true. Compared to him, any bad actor doing a Russian accent is going to be like Shakespearean Daniel Day-Lewis proportions.
Cool.
So let's start off with the questions. Let's start with you, Kareem. What did you think was the best scene in the film?
Oh, what was the best scene? Okay, so I didn't hate the film, and I'm probably enjoying the first. As I think back to it, I think the first scene that I really liked was when he's talking to the landlord's wife, and he goes from being dull to all of a sudden he starts to see things in a different light. And he's able to access her and go beyond this kind of defensive or actually offensive attitude that she has towards him. And then he's able to, like, get inside her head, and all of a sudden, you know, he's able to, like, charm her and stuff like that. And just the difference between the before, the colors and everything and the sharpness and the way he looks, all of a sudden the transition that takes place, I thought that was a pretty effective way to show that something had just come on up within him. Like a drug.
And the way they show it was really interesting, too. Like, he sees the corner of this book, and he goes back to this very specific memory because of the pill. His memory is completely wide open. And the way they did that visually, I thought was interesting. The first time I saw it in the theater, I thought it was going to be... I thought after that scene, it was going to be a pretty good movie, but it just disappointed. What do you think, Mike?
I kind of enjoyed the scenes that involved his writing, because I've mentioned before... I thought that was going to be the main source of the conflict, like all the internal struggles and stuff, and maybe like the world just doesn't understand him because he's too smart or something, but it quickly derails from that.
Yeah, I think for me, it's not a specific scene, but I really like that effect that they used during the credit sequence, and they used it a couple more times as well. And I think that really, where you start with a location and it zooms into another location, and then that seamlessly zooms into another location, and it just goes on and on like that. I thought that looked pretty beautiful and interesting.
I have to say something, though, because I actually agree. I thought the title sequence, in fact, the title sequence from both the films that we're looking at this week were absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah.
But the title sequence for Limitless, again, the first time I saw it, I was like, wow, that's totally great. But then I thought to myself, no, have you ever seen the Smack My Bitch Up video?
It's the same
Jonas
thing.
Acklin video. It came out in the 90s, probably around the same time as Fight Club and Matrix.
Yeah.
And it's basically, there's a scene where he goes and he can't remember and he ends up sleeping with the woman, and he's going through all these kind of various scenarios and they're all blurring together.
Yeah.
It's exactly the same as the Jonas Acklin video.
Yeah,
so again,
true.
It's another example of something that, like, a brilliant moment of creativity in 98 is now taken in 2011 and recreated. I think we would have been able to create something new and more exciting, more dynamic.
Yeah, you're right. I totally forgot about that. You're absolutely right. The same, I mean, the effect back then, the computer technology wasn't as advanced, so the effect itself wasn't as seamless. I think they used a lot of kind of blurring and zoom in and out effects or something like that, but the concept itself was the same and it looked pretty much the same. So yeah, you're right, it's pretty much kind of a ripoff. So I don't know what to say. I mean, I still like the way that looked, but yeah, you're absolutely right. Even the one part that I thought was creative and interesting in the film is not, like, you know, that also turns out to be a ripoff.
Yeah, I think it's the same thing when you're talking about, you know, me, I love Tarantino films, but I don't always have the context that you sometimes have because you've watched the films that he's stolen from.
Yeah.
Well, in this example, I tend to have that kind of background because I enjoy music videos and I've worked in that industry. So when these guys borrow from that particular source, I recognize it straight off and it has less of an impact, the same way, like I said, a Tarantino film might have on
and
you.
It was a super popular video when it came out. I mean, I saw it like tons of times. So yeah, the second you talked about it, it just popped in my head and I was like, oh yeah, Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. So, what did you think? What was your worst scene in the movie?
For me, it was just when she picked up the little girl and slashed the pursuer with the ice skates. I just think out of the many millions of variables she could have come up with her heightened intellect, that just seemed like the dumbest one that I probably wouldn't even come up with if I was hungover and drunk in the park. So for me, that was just a weak... that was the point where I was like, oh, this script is really beginning to go downhill.
Yeah. What do you think, Mike?
Well, I think it comes at the very end, actually, my worst scene, and it's when the effects of the pill, and we don't know if he's adjusted his dose or whatever, but he seems to be turning into Superman or something, and he has like these almost magical abilities, like you said, where he can like predict the future and feel if people are sick just by placing his hands on them.
Yeah, it just turns into Superman and just becomes, it just takes on this like supernatural quality right out of the blue. Yeah. And my worst scene is kind of connected with yours, is the way that they figure out certain plot holes with just small pieces of voiceover, which to explain, there's a scene where he starts getting blackouts because of the drug and even ends up killing somebody. And you think that's going to be a major part of the film later on, and then they just kind of toss it away with a piece of voiceover that says, well, I was careful with my diet, and if I don't drink alcohol, then that takes care of the blackouts. And they do it at the end as well, where, spoiler alert, it's Robert De Niro's character says, where are you going to get your drug from now on? And he's like, oh, it's just in my bloodstream now. You know, it's like, so it's just come up with these, like, ridiculous, easy solutions. So, Kareem, what do you think could have been done with this film to improve it?
Personally speaking, I just think that it's an interesting concept. Like I said at the beginning, if there is a drug that's available on the market and it gives you access to these kind of dormant potentials in your brain, then I think that you could really play around with what would actually happen to people if they were given heightened intellect and expanded capacity for creativity and sixth senses. What would they actually end up doing with their lives? In this particular case, they climb the kind of corporate ladder and they start making more money and they sleep with beautiful women and live vacuous, albeit very kind of like successful lives. But if I did it, I would explore that. If I did it, I would explore that more deeply. And I would say, okay, this guy's a writer. What would happen if all of a sudden he did start to write great books and he started to go more into his unconscious and he started to become the writer he always dreamed he could be? Mm. What would happen in terms of fame? What would happen in terms of his, you know, his ability to cope with the success? All kinds of stuff like that. But I definitely wouldn't have him jump from being a writer to saying, well, I've accomplished that. Next, I'm going to become a corporate yuppie douchebag.
That's true. What do you think, Mike?
Yeah, mine is kind of related. I think I would just focus on more internal things. Like, one of the main things that bugged me about this movie is, like, as soon as he starts taking the drug, he gets better looking, which I think is just shows, like, the writer's, like, lack of imagination, like, exploring things, you know? Like, they go for these visual cues and everything, whereas I would just rather see, like, maybe he speaks with a little better vocabulary or something, you know? It's just everything's external.
Yeah, that's true. And everything is so just on the nose, too. Like, when he starts writing the book and he's all into it, you see words dropping from everywhere, so nothing can be internal. Yeah. And I think for me, it should have either gone in a very kind of personal way, like you said, Kareem, or it should have gone in a completely ridiculous supernatural way where he starts to have telekinetic powers and the government is after him, or like something just like ridiculous and actiony like that. And but this way it tries to have it both ways, and I think that's part of the reason why it fails so bad. What movie would you recommend, Kareem, if someone goes into a video store and they picks up Limitless and you just like smack it out of their hands and say, buy, rent this movie instead?
Well, personally, I would choose a film like Fight Club and Matrix. It's not like those films, you've probably, most of the audience has seen those films, but like I said, if you want to see a film that was creative, original, cutting edge, and contextually ahead of its time, then those two films are going to represent much better examples of that than Limitless ever could.
So what about you, Mike?
Well, I'll have to say Seconds, But I'll save all my comments about that for the next segment.
That's true. Well, I was thinking of Seconds as well, but another film that popped into my mind, even though it doesn't have any science fiction elements at all, is The Weatherman with Nicolas Cage. That I think it's a highly underrated film, and it also has the same kind of story where this person who sees himself as this giant loser, even though he's in a good place in life financially, tries very hard to kind of reestablish himself and change his stature in life so he can basically become a more respected person. And in a way that you were saying, Kareem, it just follows his story completely internally on his way to desperately try to gain some respect from his family that's fallen apart and from his father, who's a successful author. So I think that's a much, much better film to seek out.
So our underappreciated film for this week is Seconds. It came out in 1966 and it stars Rock Hudson. Mike, tell us why you chose this film.
Well, I actually chose this movie based more on the director than anything else, because I've always been a fan of John Frankenheimer's work, especially from this period. Like The Manchurian Candidate is, I think, one of the best movies made in the 60s as well, which came out just a couple of years before this. And this movie, I think, when it came out, it was really a failure, like critically and at the box office. And I think that's just due to the fact because it's so far ahead of its time. You were talking about Fight Club and The Matrix being perfect movies for the time they came out. And I really think this movie is like the perfect movie for that same period, for the late 90s. And it was not a good movie to come out in the 60s just because it's very bleak, and after like the post-war optimism of the 50s and everything, this movie is so far away from that that it really blew my mind when I saw it.
I have to agree. When I watched this movie, it was one of those, it was just surprising to me how good it was. And just to give a bit of backstory, Mike gave me this movie maybe 8 years ago and said, you have to watch this movie. And I looked at the cover and it was 1966 and it was a black and white film, and I imagined it was going to be weird and surreal, which it was. So I left it there on my next to my TV for about 2 years and never watched it. And I watched it earlier today, and I have to say it's one of my favorite films I've ever seen. Something about that movie just struck such a particular chord with me, and I don't know what it is, but if we're going to be saying like films like, you know, David Fincher films, in particular a film like The Game, which I would say is a much closer comparison to than a film like Limitless, it's very similar. You can suddenly start to see like how much of the narrative was borrowed from a film like Seconds, and it suddenly starts to take away some of the amazing qualities of the Game, because I actually think that The Seconds, when you watch that film, you realize The Game really isn't that good.
Yeah, that's true. That's absolutely true. And the first act of it is very similar to The Game, actually. It's because this kind of, I mean, the old man in Seconds is not as financially successful as maybe Michael Douglas, but he does also, you know, he's living this kind of humdrum life, and he gets this card out of the blue and is being kind of drawn into this corporation where he has no idea what the hell's going on. It has this like very surreal, it's a place that has this very surreal quality. And I think, I mean, I don't want to point fingers here, but I think The Game looks like stole a lot from this movie. Personally, I really, really love this movie. It's because being a huge Twilight Zone fan, it's really hard to pull off a Twilight Zone type story, which takes kind of a morality tale and turns it into upside down in this kind of science fiction territory. And we've seen that fail time and time again, especially recently with like M. Night Shyamalan films. And this is a film that gets it absolutely right. Not only does it create this amazing long-form Twilight Zone episode, and on top of that, it deals with some very mature ideas that a network TV show like Twilight Zone couldn't get away with, you know?
That's what I was going to say, because it wasn't just like an interesting kind of surreal world, but there was such heart. I fell in love with the character of Rock Hudson's character. I really felt like emotionally connected to him. And usually when it's an interesting sci-fi film, I'm like, yeah, it's a cool story, but I'm not really feeling the actual characters themselves. But for whatever reason, there was something really tragic and beautiful about this character.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a science fiction story with a heart. It's very, very internalized, which is very unusual for this genre, and it really deals with kind of the meaning of life and what we're here to do and the choices that we make. And if we get the perfect life that we think we need, would we really be happy with that? And that sounds like kind of a cliche premise, but it does such an amazing job with that idea.
Well, I think it's really interesting contrasting this movie with Limitless. Like you were talking about the idea that as soon as he gets the pills in Limitless, he becomes a banker. This is exactly the opposite arc, where he's like this successful banker and he has this new life as an artist.
Well, yeah, that's
like
true.
He's going for the life that most people would rather have, I think, or at least me being an artistic person.
I agree totally. And it was interesting that that was the comparison between the two films. I didn't pick up on that at all.
Yeah, that's true. It does kind of explore the flip of that, the flip side of that coin. And it also shows how hollow of a lifestyle that could be when you're just completely alone and single and you live in this, I mean, they just give him this like beautiful house. And an interesting thing is that they give him paintings previously painted by other people, and they ask him to take credit for that to become a famous painter. And the fact that he gets this credit so easily, I don't think sits well with him either.
I kept asking myself when I saw that film, I was like, when was this made? Because it really did feel ahead of its time, the point you mentioned earlier, Mike. There was something about it that was just, it felt almost like being John Malkovich at points. You know, that kind of brilliant, quirky world where the characters are a little bit malicious, but also kind of endearing at the same time. You know,
yeah, any scene at the corporation headquarters, like, it's just so mind-blowingly weird. Like, everybody is just, like, a few degrees off normal, and it's just so frightening.
Yeah, and the other thing that's that I really love about this film, and might be the reason why it failed so badly at the box office when it first came out, is that it is uncompromisingly bleak. I mean, there is rarely any silver lining in that film. But that's kind of what I really like about it. It's a really, really dark film made at a time when people were really optimistic. I mean, this was made before the Vietnam War and the Watergate.
Yeah, and it's also one of those films that I feel like I'm going to have to watch another three or four times before I even begin to comprehend some of the deeper meanings behind it. I was wondering about the storyline and if it was somehow representing karma and these people keep coming back. You know, they'll keep trying life and the cycle of, you know, rebirth and death until they get it right. But I didn't fully understand, and I have to admit, I still don't fully understand what was going on with that story towards the end. It went off onto a tangent around death and rebirth that I didn't really understand. So I'd love to hear some feedback from you guys about what you thought that all meant.
I don't know. I've watched this movie probably five or six times, and I still am not quite sure. And I think it might just be due to, like, my age, because the first time I saw it, I was about 20 years old, and I had a much different view of it than I do now. And I feel like if I revisit it every 2 or 3 years, I'll have a different opinion.
Yeah, I feel exactly the same way. I feel like it's going to become that much more frightening as I get older as well. Like, I can't imagine watching this film again when I'm 60 or 70 years old. And also, considering the fact that, without spoiling anything, it has one of the best and most frightening kind of twist endings that I've ever seen in the movie.
Yeah, the ending, hearing you talk about it, I get chills thinking about the last, like, 5 or 10 minutes of the movie.
And in particular, the way the old man relates to him just before that, particular ending, it's amazing. Just the, again, that quality that I speak to of this character that's absolutely endearing and lovable, but with just this underscore of malice that just makes the whole scene so creepy and hard to fathom.
That's something we don't often talk about, like the acting in these movies, but I feel like every performance in here, with maybe a couple of exceptions, is so perfect for like what they're trying to make you feel. From John Randolph, who plays the old Rock Hudson, I guess, to like the old man who runs the corporation. They're just so perfect.
Yeah, something about what you said, Kareem, the themes about life and death. The thing that was really interesting to me is it almost depicts a form of virtual reality before computers were even, you know, before anybody was even talking about virtual reality. Because when you think about it, when he is giving that house in Malibu with pre-painted paintings, and everybody that surrounds him are basically fake, he's basically thrown into this virtual reality where he can selfishly live this grand life, but nothing around him is real.
Yeah, and also the scenes, the plastic surgery, there's something about that just seemed credible. It seemed like ahead of its time, because in terms of the kind of procedures that they were doing, somehow it just seemed way beyond the time frame. I don't know much about that, but just in my mind at the time, I thought that was true. And then also just the way that they talked about the restructuring and the kind of operations and the details of it, it all felt really credible. It didn't seem sci-fi and just kind of, you know, they were making stuff up just to kind of tie up the loose ends. It felt really credible, as if this was actually something that they thought about, they knew about, and could potentially happen in the future.
Yeah, and also they don't give you too much exposition about it either. It's not like a movie like Face Off, where they go through it for 10 minutes of screen time telling you exactly what they're going to do. When he walked, from the moment he walks into that office, they don't give him any specific exposition about exactly what they're going to do. And everything is kept in this really kind of creepy mystery, which makes it so much more interesting to watch.
I think that the credibility is also, when you see the John Randolph in the beginning and you see Rock Hudson in the middle playing the same character, they really pull it off to where, like, Rock Hudson, I think this is probably his best performance. I'm not a big fan of his. I don't know a lot of his movies, but you can see, like, in his face, like, all those years that he doesn't actually have.
One interesting thing about Rock Hudson is that I had the same feelings about him, because mostly of his films with Doris Day. When Mike gave me this DVD, I had the same feeling. And but yeah, I think this is his best performance that I think I've ever seen. And also an interesting bit of trivia is that apparently Rock Hudson was the one who suggested to John Frankenheimer to use an older actor for the first half of the film instead of using him and prosthetics, which I think would be awful. Even today, it would look like, it would probably look like Leonardo DiCaprio and J. Edgar or something, and it would totally take us away from the story.
Yeah, or Eddie Murphy and the Nutty Professor, which is actually how Leonardo DiCaprio looked like at the end of J. Edgar, or Bruce Willis and Sharon Stone in Alpha Dog.
Yeah.
They were just basically, you know,
yeah.
There was something, just to add something just briefly about the plastic surgery scene. I just didn't want to lose this point. There was something so terrifying about that scene where he wakes up, and it's the transition point between him when he's the older version and then him when he's the younger Rock Hudson version, and he's in this cast and he's totally terrified and he's trying to speak, but he's like a baby, he's like a child, he can't speak, and his vocal cords have been like drastically transformed, but at that point he's like a child, he's in this kind of limbo period. And I thought that was handled so well. They were describing what had happened to his vocal cords and now that he was sounding differently, and at the same time they're kind of it's a metaphor for his rebirth.
Yeah, and quickly I want to talk about like the technical details in the film. It is technically, I feel like it is way ahead of its time with the kind of off-putting angles that are really way out there, and the fast cutting sometimes. And there's this one scene in it that is very like weird and expressionist, where the old man has this dream where he's raping this woman. And that turns out to be something completely different, which is also very disturbing as well. And even Saul Bass's credit sequence, right off the beginning, it just puts you into this like very uncomfortable and odd mood.
Yeah, I think the cinematography, especially, I think it was James Wong Howe, is just like, it's so realistic and so naturalistic, but also, like you said, so impressionistic or expressionistic, I guess.
Yeah,
like where it looks totally real, but it's off and it feels so expressive.
Especially at the beginning where the young man is kind of chasing after the old man, and there's this one angle that shows just the top of his head. It's just, it just has this really weird angles and really kind of off-putting cutting, which is like a lot of those techniques were really overused in the 90s, but to have it come out like 30 years even before that was is just way ahead of its time.
You kind of see that Spike Lee, the mounted camera, you know, he used that a lot, and I was like, wow, that was very innovative. And then you see it in this film, this is in 1966. It's like, wow, you start to realize like where these ideas may have originally come from.
Yeah, that was used a lot, that typical like from the back of the guy's head, and it was just like kind of floating with him. And it's just brilliantly shot. It's and I just don't understand. I could see why it didn't make much of a splash in the 60s, but I just don't understand why it didn't become this huge cult sensation in the 90s and was rediscovered. That's the part that I don't really get.
I feel like it was just rediscovered by directors who didn't want anyone else to know, because all of a sudden their films were just like, if anyone knew about Seconds, all of a sudden, it's not to say David Fincher becomes irrelevant, obviously, but it's kind of interesting just to know that these ideas have been created before, and it takes away from some of the innovativeness and some of the uniqueness of some of these other directors. So I love this film.
Yeah.
You can probably tell.
Yeah, I mean, it's the best. It's probably my favorite long form kind of Twilight Zone episode, apart from Planet of the Apes, maybe. But this just handles it in such a more mature and insightful way.
All right, so Mike, if you could, I mean, obviously you love this film. You've seen it close to 4 or 5 times now. What out of all the scenes is your favorite?
Yeah, I'll probably say the scene with the old man right before the very end, where he's going back, where Rock Hudson's going back for another chance, and the old man is talking to him about how it's going to all work. And like you said, that kind of warm malice that the whole scene just has, I can't stop thinking about that, like just how well they balance those two feelings.
For me, I would probably pick the ending as well, and it's hard to call it my favorite scene because it terrifies me so much. It's, you know, that favorite scene sounds like I take so much pleasure out of it, but that's part of why I pick it, because it's so unbelievably powerful and so unexpected, and part of it is because it came out in the 60s, so you don't expect... You kind of expect, you know, a film from the 60s with Rock Hudson to have, even with what you've seen so far, to have kind of a happy ending. And when the ending comes, it is truly terrifying. I mean, I've seen a lot of mainstream horror films. I'm a big horror movie fan, and this to me is the ending. The last 5 minutes of this film is more frightening to me than any mainstream horror movie you can think of.
Do we know at what stage this film... At what stage of Rock Hudson's career this film was made?
It was at the height of his career. I mean, it was the Doris Day movies were, I think, either still going on or he was still at the height of that. So he was still a major movie star. And apparently when this came out in Cannes, people in the audience booed it so much that John Frankenheimer refused to get on stage. And Rock Hudson had to, like, answered these very kind of scathing questions by himself. And most of the questions were geared towards like, oh, you're, you know, all these people saying you're such a big movie star, why did you decide to make this movie?
Yeah, that's the kind of, I guess I'm just trying to get inside the mindset of Rock Hudson and why he decided to make a movie like that. And I just think it's fascinating. I just think him as an actor and him as like a celebrity and a person that I don't know much about, having watched this film, is someone I want to learn a lot more about.
I mean, of course, there's all these kind of theories going around that it was his kind of subtle attempt of coming out of the closet and, you know, with the story and everything. But, you know, that's a whole other kind of discussion, I guess.
Okay.
So what was your favorite scene, Kareem?
I wouldn't say that I have a favorite scene, but since you guys have chosen some of my favorite scenes, and since I've mentioned the scene about the guy when he comes out of plastic surgery and he's in the full bodysuit, which I found really kind of horrifying, I think... The favorite scene that I found was when he went to the party, like kind of the wild bacchanal party where they're drinking wine and getting naked. And I just thought it really represented something about the culture and the kind of breaking away from the rigid stereotype, masculine stereotype, and how he's like literally grabbed and his clothes are ripped off and he's thrown into the grapes and he's surrounded by, you know, all these people who are like loving on him and naked bodies writhing around, and then he's still fighting it, and then at a certain point he breaks out into a smile and this this transformation of character, which during the film is probably one of the few silver linings where you think, oh, that's what the film's about. The film is about him breaking free and getting in touch with his true self, which, you know, not to spoil anything, isn't what the film's about at all.
Exactly.
But I loved that scene. It was very life-affirming and definitely definitely a wild scene. A lot of nudity, a lot of, you know, kind of like
intense
images.
Yeah, for its time, too.
Images.
That was really unexpected to see, like, full frontal nudity of tons of nude men and women in this, like, stomping grapes and stuff. It's just, like, it's way, way ahead of its time as far as that kind of imagery is concerned.
So, Mike, what scene, if any, did you not like?
Well, I really love, like, 99% of this movie, but my one scene that I think has some problems is the one that you just mentioned, just because I feel like it goes on a little long, and, like, I think maybe it's because it is a silver lining that you can see. It kind of felt a little untrue to the whole theme of the movie, but that's such a small gripe for me. I can't really complain about that.
Yeah, I think if you really, I really, really love this movie, and I think it's an unsung masterpiece, and if you really had to twist my arm, I would pick that scene as well, but not because of a completely technical standpoint. I think I appreciate the kind of artful, experimental approach to it, but some of the shots where it's all out of focus and it's just going crazy, it just felt more like John Frank and I were decided to throw like this orgy in his backyard and just pulled out a camera and started filming. But but I mean, it could have been a little bit shorter, maybe that would have worked better. But the thing about that silver lining when he finally starts to enjoy himself, that to me, his performance when he goes from 0 to like 120 in 2 seconds, it felt so artificial and off-putting, and I think that was on purpose, that even that little moment of silver lining had this really eerie and inhuman quality to it, which I thought was just perfect.
Wait, so both of you think that your worst scenes are my favorite scene?
I mean, I wouldn't call it worse because I love every scene in this movie.
Yeah, that scene is not bad at all. It's just, of all of them, I think it's the weakest.
So what about
you? Okay, well, whatever. my worst scene, I'm not sure what my worst scene is. I didn't have any scenes that for me were out of place, didn't feel good. I felt like the whole film from start to finish was interesting. I wouldn't necessarily change anything. You know, there's certain things that don't make sense to me, but I think that's what makes this movie so great. It means that I'm actually going to have to, you know, watch it a few more times, not because it's on TV, but because I actually want to understand what the hell that guy was trying to get across in the message.
Yeah. I think if we could do that, then I'm changing my thing as well. I don't have a worse scene because I really love this movie. And I don't think that scene me and Mike are talking about, I mean, I don't think that's a bad scene at all. It's just that's the one that sticks in my head as like, you know, not as technically perfect as the rest of them, which really doesn't make it bad at all.
So, Mike, if you were given the chance to remake this film, would you do it differently or would you say, no, how dare I even, like, try?
No, I think about that a lot, actually, because every time I watch it, I imagine they remake it with Denzel Washington or something, you know, like they did with the Manchurian Candidate. And I really feel like it was so far ahead of its time that it's like timeless now, because it floats perfectly through, you know, all times now, because it's not really connected to anything.
Yeah, I have good news for you, though, Mike. It was up for a remake a little while ago, and the director was going to be the same guy who directed Terminator 3. So that gives you kind of an idea how awful that would turn out. But thankfully...
Well, I'll just say it could have been the guy who directed Terminator 4.
Yeah, McGee, that would be worse, definitely. But yeah, I wouldn't hold high hopes on that. But thankfully, it fell through and it didn't get made. And
I think it has been remade, and I think it's been remade as The Game. It just hasn't been, you know, like, it hasn't been given its...
It's an unofficial remake.
It really is. I mean, it's really true. There's a scene when he first meets the guy who's there to process him.
Yeah.
And the guy pulls out, you know, you're not going to eat your chicken, and he starts eating his chicken while he's processing him. And there's this kind of, like, unprofessional quality of this guy who's trying to sell him on, like, the biggest decision of his life, and he's there eating chicken. Like, totally unprofessional, right? if you remember the scene from the game where that dude does the same thing and he's like, yeah. do you mind if I eat my Chinese food in front of you? And
yeah, so absolutely, that's true.
It's a complete, I mean, I'm not saying it's a complete copy, but you can tell that there are certain aspects that
Oh, man, that's a lot more direct than what I was thinking. I was mostly thinking, like, every scene that takes place in that weird corporation that Michael Douglas goes to is so similar to the scenes in Seconds. It's just, but yeah, that's true. That's a direct kind of ripoff. Of course, David Fincher would probably call it an homage instead.
Yeah, and I don't want to go to a ripoff or anything like that. Yeah. I think that it's great. Like David Fincher or whoever the screenwriter was, I don't know who wrote the game, but clearly was like, saw Seconds and was like, yeah, I mean, I love this film. It's part of an influence for me. Yeah. And I think that the game, you know, had I seen it by itself, I think it's a sleek thriller. I don't think it's a brilliant film, but I think it's a sleek, enjoyable thriller.
Yeah.
But, you know, having watched Seconds, I'm like, oh, wow. You know, it's really not that ahead of its time. But Seconds, made in 1966, was, like, so far ahead of its time.
And the sad thing is the game is released on Criterion while Seconds is still, you know, it should be... This is a film that begs to be released on Criterion, in my opinion.
Well, when the people at Criterion hear our podcast, I think that history will be rewritten.
I actually sent them an email, and I told them if they could release this movie on Criterion. Because when I first saw it, I was, like, so just blown away by it. I was like, I actually sent Criterion an email saying, why don't you release this on your collection?
And so the final question for you, Mike, is, you know, if someone's going to the video store and they're about to pick out one film, and you're going to say, no, actually pick Seconds, because Seconds is a much better version or a much better option. What film would you say skip and choose Seconds instead?
I'm not really sure. I think I would, rather than go for something similar thematically, I would say, like, oh, you think you're about to pick up, like, a really innovative, ahead-of-its-time movie, like maybe The Matrix, like you said, or something like that. I would say, no, pick this up, because this was made, like, 50 years ago, and it still will have, like, when you watch it, you will not believe how creative and personal and amazing it is.
Yeah. Yeah, and it might still be ahead of its time. In 2013, I still think, like, there's a couple of decades for, you know, when it will actually catch up to today's audience, because I still find it really, really just brilliant in that way. I would say rent this instead of any M. Night Shyamalan movie. That M. Night Shyamalan films are basically, you know, feature-length Twilight Zone episodes. And even the ones that I think kind of work, like The Sixth Sense and Unbreakable, that are probably dated by now. But yeah, definitely over crap like, you know, The Village or Signs or Lady in the Water, that tries to blend in this kind of science fiction premises with very personal stories and end up with horrible, horrible movies.
Yeah, you forgot to mention The Last Airbender.
Yeah, that's true. That's not really a Twilight Zone movie. That's just a straight-up crap movie.
Yeah. Well, for me, you know, I think one thing you guys know about me is that I tend not to go back and watch older movies. And, you know, that's more out of ignorance than anything else. But I guess there's some kind of bias towards films that are made recently, because I feel like I'm going to be able to relate to them better. And two films that have helped me overcome this stupid decision that I made some point in my life are The Battle of Algiers and Seconds. The Battle of Algiers, we watched that in film class, and my teacher showed it to me, and I was like, oh, it's black and white, it was made a long time ago, it's probably going to be dated. And that film blew me away. It was as relevant today as it was when it first came out, and it totally had me rethink my relationship to older films. And Seconds is the same thing. It has that effect on me where I'm like, I feel as alive watching a film like Seconds as I do watching a film like Fight Club. And that, for me, is like the highest form of praise, and it will encourage me to go back. Maybe not watch the ones that he's done with Doris Day, but other Rock Hudson films, for sure.
Yeah, this is unlike any Rock Hudson film I have ever seen. And I don't think there is anything like it in that sense. So you're in for a surprise in that. But I think, yeah, and I think, I thought you were going to pick The Game, so I didn't mention that one. But yeah, instead of The Game, I would just rent this.
Yeah, just watch both of them, because you can.
Yeah, that's true.
I think that's one more thing I'd like to say. I think it's a real tragedy that this wasn't more accepted, because it really shows, like, the potential that John Frankenheimer had as a director, because this was a really very personal movie for him to make. And since it was so, because it was so dismissed by the public, it really set him on a track of making a different kind of movie, you know?
I mean, like I said, people at Cannes booed this movie, and everybody, when it first came out, hated it because they didn't know what the hell to do with it. And yeah. that's the biggest tragedy with this film, is because, like you said, with Battle of Algiers is a very accomplished film, and a lot of people respect it, and it should be. It's a masterpiece. But I just don't understand why Seconds, over time, didn't become this big kind of pop culture phenomenon the way films like Psycho or even Peeping Tom did, you know? So that's the thing that's kind of a tragedy for me. And it really does show Frankenheimer's range, because it's also unlike any film he's ever done.
So thank you for joining us this week. Once again, our overrated film was Limitless, starring Bradley Cooper and Robert De Niro, and our underappreciated film was Seconds, starring Rock Hudson. We hope you've enjoyed our podcast this week, and we'll be back again next week with two films, one that's overrated and one that's underappreciated. And be sure to leave your comments at the bottom. We want to hear what you have to say about our podcast.
Thank you, guys. Bye.
Thanks, guys. Take it easy.